coming up next on RCR. Speak Free with Simon O'Connor. In a topsy-turvy world, good old-fashioned ideas may seem foreign to some, but still make a lot of sense to many. Join Simon as he speaks with local and international guests to explore the values and perspectives that shape our world. Get your common sense fixed with conversations that celebrate democracy, freedom, and our fundamental rights. It's Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio. You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, hi, everyone. We are well into summer here, of course, in New Zealand, and we're also in that holiday season. And probably and arguably there is no bigger or more significant day in New Zealand's national calendar than Waitangi Day. And obviously, lots of conversations ahead about the nature of Waitangi Day. They're mainly political. But I thought we should take a little bit of a different angle and approach it from a historical point of view. So I'm welcoming to the show someone who is familiar to listeners here on RCR, and that's Professor Paul Moon. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Simon.
Listeners should know, actually by way of introduction, Paul, as I say, you're a professor of history at AUT. You've spoken with us before on a range of topics, but yeah, you have done a lot of writing, thinking, and exploration around New Zealand's history in particular. So I wonder if we start with just giving listeners a bit of a sense of what actually did happen on and around Waitangi Day. We know a treaty was signed, but what was actually happening? Who were some of the big players and what happened on that day?
Right. Well, if we could go back, say, to August the previous year, very much at the last moment, really, the British government drew up instructions for a treaty with New Zealand. And it gave these to William Hobson, who was what we'd now call semi-retired as a naval captain. He was on half pay, which is really where captains were sort of kept in storage in case they were needed again. So he was sent to New Zealand. He arrived in Sydney on Christmas Eve, 1839. And he sailed to New Zealand and arrived at the end of January 1840 in the Bay of Islands. And he was charged with writing a treaty and getting it signed initially by local chiefs and then other chiefs around the country. And from the time he arrived, he began to make notes, and he and a few others worked on it. We're really unsure who wrote the treaty specifically, which is surprising for such a significant document.
We do know about the translators but we don't know who actually wrote it.
Yeah, and the record's inconsistent with the English version, certainly. James Busby, who was the British resident in the country from 1833 to 1840, he had a hand in the text, there's no question about that. But over the course of his life, his own account of how much he contributed changed to the point where towards the end of his life in the late 1860s, he was saying, I contributed almost all the text of the treaty. Now, that's an exaggeration on his behalf, but it gives you an idea that there's no certainty about who wrote what exactly. But putting that aside, the final text was finished on the 4th of February, the English text. And it was assembled from these instructions that Hobson had been given in August the previous year. That afternoon, on the 4th of February, about 4 in the afternoon, a copy of this English version was sent to Henry Williams, the missionary. He was based at Paihia at the time. And he and his brother and his son set to work translating this into Te Reo. Now, Williams was a superb translator. He had translated parts of the New Testament. He gave sermons in Te Reo. He had translated the Declaration of Independence 5 years earlier and did a pretty good job of that. And he's now responsible for translating this document. And by the 5th of February, the morning of the 5th, the job is completed. Not satisfactorily, but it's completed. And then there's a meeting at Waitangi, which Hobson had organized with local chiefs. He spends about 4 hours from 10 in the morning explaining the treaty, discussing it, and this conversation is being translated by Williams and others present who were fluent in both languages. And a lot of the chiefs, of course, were pretty fluent in English by this stage. So there's a four-hour discussion about this agreement, and Hobson says, come back on the 7th, we're going to sign it. Well, the chiefs retreated that afternoon to their camps nearby where they'd gathered. And they decided, some of them, that they were ready to sign much sooner. So on the morning of the 6th, Hobson, who'd gone back on a ship to sleep that evening, that morning he got the message, you have to come to shore now and sign this treaty. So on the 6th of February, which was the unplanned date, the first signatures were put to the agreement.
I have to say, there's so many elements to this, I don't know, but that's one in particular. I had no idea. They were expecting at least another day, but they moved, well, certainly much faster than Hobson expected.
Hobson thought, well, the chiefs will need to talk about it. And his idea of talking about it was the next morning they would get up and start discussing it. What he didn't realise is that a lot of those chiefs spent the whole of that evening and into the early hours of the morning discussing it. They were impatient to work their way through it. And so by the morning of the 6th, they were ready to sign. And the fear was if Hobson wasn't present, they would just go back to their homes, and it would be much more difficult to call them back again and say, look, now we're going to sign it. You don't want to miss that opportunity.
Yeah, even though you're a captain on half pay, get up and do your job.
That's right.
So just taking a step back for a moment, the instructions to do a treaty with the tribes of New Zealand, that would, and we've talked about this before, I think this was a relatively novel, if that's the right word, a rather novel approach from the British government of the time. Would that be fair to say? Had they done something like this elsewhere?
There were elements in those instructions that were unprecedented. Among much else, this is obviously something that's consistent with treaties generally, but in this case it's specific. Britain formally recognised Maori sovereignty. It said the sovereignty was fragmented among various tribes. There wasn't a single sovereign ruler of the country, but it recognised that sovereignty, and it had to, because treaties were agreements between sovereign nations. And so Britain had to recognise Maori sovereignty as a precursor to getting the treaty signed. It gave all sorts of instructions about what Hobson was to do, the departments he was to establish, the fact that one of the functions of the new government that Hobson would create through the treaty would be to so-called civilise Maori, to bring them into the modern world, as it was described. He had all sorts of other things that were included, and so the treaty became a pretty impoverished reflection of those instructions. The instructions go on for page after page. The treaty ends up being about four sentences long.
Funny, because I was going to ask the question of how much did Hobson and his friends improvise, but you're saying that actually what came out of the Foreign Office, I don't know what they would have called it at the time, the British sent quite full instructions to him, and as you were intimating, he came down to only a few small clauses.
That's right, and frustratingly, the British didn't give him a draft of the text. They said, here's the background instructions, you create the text yourself. Now, most of us, I suspect, would require expertise in that field. Hobson certainly didn't have it. Hobson left school about the age of 11, joined the Navy. So he wasn't an expert in constitutional legal issues. Busby, who was helping him, had stayed at school till the age of 15. So these weren't great intellects putting their powerful minds to this treaty. They were struggling, I think, in some sense. And it's remarkable they produced what they did, but you can see there are a lot of shortcomings when you set the text of the treaty against the content of the instructions.
Do you know if there was any commentary back from the British after that, where there's notes saying to Hobson, dear William, why did you do such a simple job, or the equivalent? Sorry to be slightly flippant, but I think you get what I'm angling at.
No, absolutely. And the answer is very instructive. The answer is no. The British just didn't seem concerned. When Hobson sent back the treaty, copies of the treaty, the English and Maori versions, they effectively went back into storage in Britain, and that was it. As far as the British officials were concerned, it's job done. And we see the treaty as really the epicentre of a lot of what happens in the country constitutionally. As far as the British were concerned, it was a trivial document signed in a very remote location where the Crown had barely any interests. So as far as they were concerned, the treaty was written. Great. Let's move on.
I mean, it is quite remarkable, isn't it? Probably a good lesson in historicity as well, as in what we think of today. We can't, if you will, project back into the past. So on the day itself, on the 6th, we've obviously got that famous painting of Hobson and others with, I think, a flag-bedecked table and different Chiefs signing? I mean, who were some of the significant figures from Māoridom who were there on the day?
Right. Well, firstly, the picture's not accurate because it's painted, I think, about 100 years later.
Oh, really?
Hobson's wearing a naval uniform, and of course, he because he was caught off guard, he was in his civilian clothes when he's being rowed on shore to sign the treaty. So there are a few anomalies in that painting, but it's I think it was prepared for the centennial commemorations in 1940. But the first chief to sign was Huneheke, who belonged to a hapu called Te Mata Rahurahu. And Heke, by birth, was one of the most senior chiefs in Northland. And he said when he signed it, he made a very interesting statement. He was the first chief to sign it. And he said, "I signed this treaty with my hand, but with the mana of my ancestors." And he mentioned a couple of them, Kahoro and Kotahawha, two very famous Ngāpuhi fighting chiefs who were his ancestors. And so it's pretty clear, I think, from that statement that Heke imbued a lot of importance into this in this treaty. It wasn't something flippant. It wasn't something that, oh, well, they want us to sign it, we'll sign it. As I said, they'd had 4 hours of discussion with Hobson the previous day. They'd had many more hours discussion among themselves afterwards. Now, some chiefs did sign it. Some didn't. Some refused to. There was reluctance on behalf of some chiefs. The Catholic bishop, Pompallier, who had arrived in the country just under 2 years earlier, had encouraged some chiefs not to sign it, because he said, "You've got to be careful that you'll fall under the control of the British," and with the implication, better wait till the French come.
Yes, I was going to say, well, as a Catholic myself, I you know, that's Catholic mischief right there.
Yes, well, it may well be. But most of the chiefs didn't give too much regard to Pompallier's advice. But there were some chiefs who didn't sign it, and that's important too, because the fact that some chiefs didn't sign it is as strong as indication as you can get that there was no real force or compulsion used when it came to signing. It wasn't as though the chiefs were cowering in the face of this big imperial power. They were, in fact, the instructions said that Hobson had to get the phrases "free and intelligent consent." The chiefs had to sign the treaty willingly and understand what they were signing, and it was something that was mandated by the British.
Isn't that something? Speaking of Bishop Pompallier, there's always been this, I'd call it apocryphal talk about a fourth clause around religious toleration. Is it my understanding that really that is just an apocryphal story that's been inserted years later?
Many years late. In fact, in the 1990s, that was invented. It was created by the Catholic Bishops' Conference. And the Anglicans didn't want to sort of, you know, lose face in this, so they quickly adopted it too. The idea was that Pompallier had said, "Look, what about those chiefs who are Catholics? Will they be covered by the treaty?" And Hobson read out a short statement that was prepared that said, "If you're a Protestant chief, a Catholic chief, or if you retain traditional Maori beliefs, you're covered by the treaty." He didn't need to say that because it's pretty obvious by the text that no one's excluded. But nonetheless, it was spoken at Waitangi. Now, according to the eyewitness account, none of the chiefs understood what the purpose of that statement was. It didn't make sense to them. They certainly didn't request it. And there the matter lay. It was never spoken of at any of the other treaty signings around the country, as far as we know. So it was spoken to about 10% of the chiefs who signed the treaty. It was one of dozens or hundreds of statements made that day. And that's it, forgotten. Hobson never mentioned it as a possible article of the treaty. Pompallier himself never mentioned it as a possible article of the treaty. Britain didn't regard it as such, and there's no contemporaneous evidence that the chiefs regarded it as an article. So as far as Aram's concerned, it's a minute detail that probably should have floated off into historical oblivion, but it didn't. It was resurrected by these bishops, and since then there's been a debate going on about is it an article, isn't it an article, and so on. The consensus seems to be from most groups that it's not, but there are some people who think, well, it is a secret article and it guarantees freedom of religion and so forth. Clearly, if you look at the text, that's not part of it.
No, and it's why I raise it, because it's a bit of mischief that seems to pop up from time to time and take on a life far more disproportionate to what did happen. But one really small quick question on it, is it not minuted, but you talk about this 4 hours of discussions backwards and forwards between Hobson and the chiefs. Was someone there recording it in some way, or is a lot of this held within sort of oral tradition? And how do we sort of know about that discussion?
We know very little about it. We know how long it went because Hobson reported back to his superiors in Sydney that I spent 4 hours explaining the treaty. And one quote I think that was captured towards the end was, and I'm summarising this or paraphrasing it rather, Hobson said to the chiefs, "Look, if you don't understand it now, you never will. After 4 hours of explanation, you should get it." So I think he was getting a bit frustrated. He was recovering from quite serious illness a day or two earlier. So after 4 days in this, 4 hours in the sun, that was probably enough for him. But very little was recorded. Colenso makes a few notes about what some chiefs said, some of the speeches they gave, but these are very slender. And it might be, I don't know, perhaps 10 or so chiefs, and it's a sentence or so from each. So it's hardly representative. And so unfortunately, we just don't know what everyone was thinking at the time.
I find it remarkable. It's only my perspective, and it's something we touched on a bit earlier, is, yeah, for us today, this is a very significant day, a very significant document. And if we were signing an equivalent document today, there'd be videos, there'd be filming, not a word would be missed. And yet here we were on the 6th of February, or sorry, the 5th of February, as they're discussing. Little attention or depth was given to it. It's quite remarkable, but it does tell us something about the dynamics in play at the time.
And of course, it reflects back on what the purpose of this agreement was. And above all else, and it had many other functions, but above all else, Britain wanted to extend its jurisdiction to its subjects living in New Zealand. Up until this time, if you're European, you killed someone in New Zealand, British law didn't extend here. You couldn't be tried in New Zealand, imprisoned in New Zealand, or anything like that. So as long as you remained in the country, you could be reasonably safe. Britain wanted to extend its jurisdiction in the country. This is an issue that had bothered it for decades, and it held back and held back, and finally it relented in 1839, and the instructions for the treaty were the result of that. So from the perspective of people at the time, one of the two big issues of the treaty was that it was here to allow Britain to exercise its jurisdiction over its subjects living in the colony. The other one was that Britain promised to investigate all land purchases prior to the treaty, and if any purchase was found to be deficient, it would be returned to its original hapu owners.
Did much of that, I mean, a slight tangent, but did that happen? And excuse my ignorance. It did.
And great dismay. Busby, who was the resident, eventually lost, when I say eventually, decade and a half later, lost something like 23,000 acres of land that he had purchased. It was pretty noble intention, but it became corrupted because what the Crown ended up doing in the 1850s is examining land purchases prior to 1840, deciding this was unfairly acquired. Now, Busby managed to assemble 13 chiefs who had sold the land to him. They all attested that he paid a very good price for it, but that evidence was ignored. But the Crown took this land, but it didn't give it back to Hapu. It sold it on to new settlers. So what they called the old settlers, the people who had come to the country prior to 1840, were at a huge disadvantage later on.
Gosh. God, there's a whole nother learning. I'm thoroughly actually enjoying this. There's, you know, something, again, that's been so much of our nation's history and done my own studies, not obviously to your level, but, you know, the insights, the things I had never fully appreciated. Jumping back to the days itself, because you mentioned, obviously, the 6th, Hobson's called to sign with a small number of chiefs. The treaty itself then went on a bit of a, well, not probably a road trip strictly, a boat trip, because I know where I live in Auckland, around the corner, there's a place called Karaka Bay. The treaty was brought here and local iwi signed. So it, clearly for days, weeks, if not months, the copies of the treaty were circulating throughout the land. Would that be right?
It's exactly right. In fact, probably up until about September 1840. So although Waitangi Day, this is the 6th of February, that's really the first signing. And different hapu and iwi around the country have their own particular dates that their ancestors signed the treaty. And it was taken partly by boat, as you say, partly overland. There were copies made. One of the problems was that I think there were about 200 copies printed of the treaty. But there were about
200.
Well, yes, and this, the idea was that those chiefs who signed it would be given a copy. The problem is there's about 542 chiefs who signed it. So well over half never got a copy of the treaty. And that's a problem. If you're giving consent to an agreement, you would expect you'd have a copy of the agreement you've given consent to. And the majority of the chiefs didn't. There are also problems about the quality of explanations that, in fact, there's Henry Williams, who translated the treaty. His son, Edward Marsh Williams, went with Thomas Bunbury around part of the country with copies of the treaty to get Maori to sign it. And the idea was they'd have a sheet with a signature sheet attached to it. They'd give the chiefs a copy, but they'd keep this signature sheet in the original. But clearly from that account, you can see they're not giving good explanations of what the text of the treaty is about. So various hapu have their own distinct idea about the treaty because they were told a particular interpretation of it.
And they weren't getting, if you will, the four-hour discussion.
No, they weren't even getting a written copy. So literally what they were told was the treaty for them.
Isn't that something? And then I suppose, so there's so much history within this. It's where to start or to enter in. But it then went on as a national day to be relatively forgotten. Again, we make a big deal of it today and in this modern era. But is it my understanding that Waitangi Day was initially not really a day of particular focus or celebration?
Well, I mean, the treaty itself, from about the end of 1845, when Governor Fitzroy was fired, and he was probably the last governor who took the treaty seriously, and he was fired partly because of that. He was replaced by George Grey, who had a very different view. And you could say that from 1845 rather to 1975, that 130-year period, the treaty went into sort of a constitutional hibernation in that it didn't really inform government policy or legislation. And so the next big thing that happens in New Zealand is the 1852 Constitution Act, big because it creates a parliament and a very narrow representative democracy. And so the origins of our system of government go back to the 1852 Constitution Act. And the treaty is not mentioned in that act. Very interesting. And the treaty barely gets any mention in parliament or legislation up until 1975. But what happens, of course, is that it pops up in other forms. So in 1932, the Governor General Bledisloe gifts the Treaty House, that's the house at Waitangi that Busby built, it was given to Hobson. He gives that and the land around it, he gives it to the nation. And 2 years later, you get the first what's called Waitangi Day. And there's about 10,000 people turn up, which is quite a number. Mm. And over the next four decades, it sort of evolves into a national day. And to put it roughly, you could say this is a sort of pubescent period in the nation's history where it's, on the one hand, it's trying to break free from the parental shadow of Britain, and New Zealand's trying to forge its own identity and try to wriggle loose from being just a British colony. It's going to have its own national day, its own emblems, and so on. But on the other hand, it's the very thing that it's adopting is shows that it's still beholden to Britain, to this colonial legacy. So it's a day that attracts some attention. But then in the 1970s, in fact, 1974, Norm Kirk makes it a public holiday, the 6th of February, and it's called New Zealand Day. And that's, if you like, the tail end. Yeah, so it's a Labour government.
I thought that was Muldoon who did that, as in the naming of it.
And that's what most people think. It's quite the other way around. Muldoon actually changed it to Waitangi Day. So Kirk, the Labour Prime Minister, called it New Zealand Day, and it was part of that burgeoning sense of national identity. This is a day where all New Zealanders celebrate so-called the creation of New Zealand. There's no sense that New Zealand was created in 1840 if you were around in 1840. It's a much later imposition on that history. So by the 1970s, it's the national day. National changes its name to Waitangi Day, which is what it had been since the 30s. And it attracted protest, commemoration, and all sorts of other things, onlookers, holidaymakers, and it's continued to do that since.
Yeah, well, there's that famous photo, I'm not sure who took it, of Kirk walking across the marae with a young boy, I think, in a Waitangi celebration, and it's often used in contrast to what's happening today as a much greater I was going to say protest, that's probably a little bit uncharitable. Much more robust discussions ahead in recent years. So there's been quite an evolution, would that be the right word, of just how Waitangi Day is understood and expressed?
There has been. But there's a bit of inertia, I suspect, too, because if you look at the heated period of Waitangi days with, you know, there's police clashes and so on, for the last several years, there hasn't been much of that. And there was Helen Clark, who wouldn't attend one year. This year we've got the Prime Minister not going to Waitangi either, going to other events. So one of the arguments, of course, is that other parts of the country equally need the attention of Prime Ministers. But there's a sense that some of the heat has been taken out of what happens at Waitangi. Yes, there's still going to be disputes. There's still going to be confrontations, protests, people expressing different views and so on. But I think part of the reason why the heat's been taken out of it is that after several years, you'd have to ask, what does that achieve? And it seems to be that the place where the discussion is taking place now is different. So if you look at the latest, the hikoi that took place recently over the ACT Treaty Principles Bill, that converged in Wellington. That was the focal point of this massive hikoi. The organisation of it took place largely online. So the conventional idea that we'll go to Waitangi and we're going to protest this, that and the other, partly technology and circumstances have changed that, but also the work of the Waitangi Tribunal. And I think this is cynically why National kept the tribunal going, because it was a pressure valve in a way that if things get too heated, well, look, go to the tribunal. That's where you resolve these issues, not protesting. So, yes, protests still happen, but gradually Waitangi Day sort of receded in the sense of the national drama that it used to have. And this is one of the risks, I think, that rather than people hating Waitangi Day or loving it, the growing reaction from some groups seems to be, we just don't care. And that's not a good thing. People have sort of almost cut themselves adrift from the moorings and saying, we don't care about this anymore, about this so-called founding document or Day of National Significance. It's a holiday for us. That's all that matters. And that lack of engagement perhaps is more threatening than any sort of dispute, debate or protest about the treaty.
I think so. And if I might, I think that's actually a really nice way to sort of wrap this discussion up, because, you know, part of the reason, not the main reason to bring you on to discuss this, is actually to delve into what it means and what happened and why things happened the way they did. And as I've expressed a few times, there's a few little gems that I had no idea about that you've introduced today. And, you know, a significant day in our history. And I suppose, like any treaty, there's always going to be different views and perspectives. And if I'm not misparaphrasing what you've said at the end, in fact, for all its messiness, for its protest to constructive conversations and its history, it's actually engaging with it where the mature approach is, rather than trying to walk away and just say, it's just a day off.
That's exactly right. And the analogy's often been used, it's rather like a marriage, that no marriage relationship is perfect and there will be tensions along the way and so on. But what makes the marriage work is the way you engage with the other partner. And one of the things guaranteed not to make a marriage last is if you disengage. And there's probably a message in there somewhere.
It's sort of a two for the price of one on RCR today. We've got a good historical perspective and a little bit of marriage advice at the same time, which is really welcome.
You're welcome, Simon.
Paul, I'm always grateful for your time. And look, thank you so much for coming on the show and just, giving us this, I think, quite a fresh, or a refreshing, actually, that's the better word, I think, a refreshing perspective on Waitangi Day.
Not a problem. Thanks very much.
So that was Professor Paul Moon. He's a professor of history at AUT University.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.